This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Sigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 105th in a series of monthly interviews with security gurus, and we have a very seriously great guru happy to have with me here today, Whitfield Diffie. Whitfield Diffie is an American cryptographer and a consulting professor at Stanford's Center for International Security and Cooperation. He's worked at MITRE, the Stanford AI Lab, Northern Telecom, and as CSO of Sun Microsystems. He's best known for discovering the concept of public key cryptography in 1975, an idea he jointly developed and expanded with Martin Hellman. Public key cryptography not only revolutionized the crypto field, it also changed the crypto community forever. Whit has a BS in math from MIT and an honorary doctorate from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. He was awarded the IEEE Hamming Medal and with Ralph Merkel and Martin Hellman, and he has a whole bunch of other awards as well. Whit lives in California. Let's start with public key cryptography. So long ago in a galaxy far, far away, you left your post at the Stanford AI Lab to work on cryptography. Can you sort of explain what happened and how you got the public key cryptography idea?
Well, it starts in the summer of 1972 when Larry Roberts, who was funding the ARPANET, went to see Howard Rosenblum at NSA with the very reasonable proposition, hey, we have a $100 million a year military research project here and we ought to think about security. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't in that conversation, but what I infer is that they probably agreed about that, but they couldn't agree about the next steps because Roberts didn't want to fund any secret research and Rosenblum didn't want to do anything else.
Right.
So Roberts drives back to his office in Roslyn and he has a job in which his PIs, principal investigators, come around with their hats in their hands and they have to listen to whatever he wants to talk about. So that week he talks about network security. And one of the people who came by was my boss, John McCarthy, and he got all excited about the subject, and he came back out to the lab, and he chatted us up about network security, and several people got interested, but I was the only one who stayed interested. Hmm. And at the time, of course, what dominated network security in our minds, it wouldn't today because the problem's been solved, is the best solved part. But at the time, the problem seemed to be one of cryptography.
Right.
And so I began studying cryptography. And 6 months later, John was fed up to his back teeth because I was being supported by NSA with under-the-table money to work on a different problem, the as-yet-unsolved problem of proof of correctness of programs.
Right.
And so I took an indefinite leave of absence. It turned out to terminate after a year. They sent me a check. So long, fat ass. I began traveling around the country. I had originally intended to travel around the world, but this was interrupted by my first discovery, which is meeting my wife in New Jersey. And without that discovery, I probably wouldn't have made any of the others. We began traveling together. And in the late summer of 74, I went to visit the cryptographic laboratory at IBM Yorktown Heights. I really went to see a man named Alan Tritter, who called himself the biggest man in computer science. Mm. He weighed 500 pounds. And Tritter is one of the famous first generation of phone hackers, along with Charlie Pine and some other people. And he introduced me to his boss, Alan Conheim, who's head of the mathematics department, and they were the people, they made a major input to the development of what appeared 2 years later as the U.S. data encryption standard.
Oh, interesting.
And Conheim was very secretive. He only told me one thing, and since then he's wished he hadn't said that. He said, you know, two people can work on a problem better than one. And, you know, you should go look up my old friend Marty Hellman when you get back to Stanford. He's interested in this stuff, too. Mm-hmm. So I got back to Stanford, and we were staying with another computer scientist, Leslie Lamport, who lived up in just won the Turing Award. We lived up in Oakland, and I called Marty, and he graciously granted me half an hour of his time at 4:30 some afternoon. I no longer know the date. And we drove down there, and Mary took the car and went off and did something else and called in about an hour later. And Marty and I were still talking. And each of us found the other one, the best informed person willing to talk about cryptography he'd yet run into.
Very nice.
And he invited us to dinner. We stayed till 11 at night. Not only did he and I get along as families, we got along. His mother-in-law is a dog breeder, and they love dogs, and my wife could recognize 300 breeds of dog at a glance. And altogether, we worked together for 4 years, and we became a big pain in Alan Kahnheim's tush. But during that period, we did two very visible things. One was we developed public key cryptography,
right.
And the other was that we criticized the proposed data encryption standard, mm-hmm. And that the two things were confused, and with the result that public key cryptography was attacked at a point that it was still just research, was attacked as though it were a competing product that was,
right.
In fact, was very good for its publicity.
Right. That's very interesting. So the criticism was about key length in DES, basically? Is that right?
I limited myself to criticizing the key length of DES. Mm-hmm. I probably also said that, I thought they were too secretive about design principles or something.
Sure.
But I believe I was very careful never to suggest that anyone had put a trap door in this. Other people in the squabble were less prudent about that, and I don't keep track of the matter.
But, right. Well, I mean, later work showed, especially on DES, but also Triple DES, the side channel analysis that Paul Kotcher and others did showed that there were some design issues.
That has very little. It's not that it has nothing to do with the cryptographic system. You can do something within the cryptographic systems, mm-hmm. against these various covert channels that appear.
Right.
DES isn't so bad in comparison with the exponentiation systems. Diffie-Hellman and RSA,
right.
have a power usage curve that means you can detect zeros and ones in the exponent unless you code them or implement them very carefully to present that. I can believe that there are side channel attacks against DES, but I don't think it's as vulnerable as some other things.
No, that's interesting.
And
so,
I very, very much doubt anybody thought deeply enough to build that kind of vulnerability in the 70s.
That's probably true. So this podcast has lots of listeners, many of whom are not very familiar with cryptography. Can you kind of explain in simple terms?
Maybe most of them weren't 60 or 70 years old.
Yeah, right.
Didn't remember a squabble of 40 years ago anyway.
Which is partially why we're talking about this stuff, because I think it's important that we all know where many of these things came from. Can you explain the notion of splitting public and private keys and how that impacts key distribution in terms that normal hardcore geeks that aren't math people might understand?
Do my best given my own limited understanding of mathematics. The classical technique of cryptography is purely an amplifier. You take the key, which is small, 100 bits or something like that, and you amplify the security of the key to be the security of the message, mm-hmm. which could be gigabits. And the problem with that technique, it works very well within a certain domain, but the difficulty is that you really have to start out with a fairly intimate relationship with the person you're talking to. That is to say, you have to share a secret.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to build a really large-scale system, and at the time we didn't envision what has happened, but my model of everything was I wanted to secure all the telephones in North America. And a loose estimate, I figured there were 100 million phones, and that's a moderate scale system, and by conventional techniques, that sort of requires 10 to the 16th keys, and that's a significant number, that sort of reasoning.
Right.
So what public key cryptography in either of its two manifestations, Diffie-Hellman or RSA, does is to split the keying information into two components, the public component and the private component. And the two function a little bit differently. Diffie-Hellman is very much like a perfect system for bridge bidding. You know, North and South are talking to each other a little better than East and West are understanding them, because North and South can each see one of the hands they're discussing, whereas East and West can't see either of them.
Right.
And in principle, so you imagine a negotiation, and the negotiation takes place between two people entirely in public, and all the observers listen to every bid and every response, but at the end of the discussion, the two negotiants know a secret in common that none of the observers know.
Very nice.
So that's the technique, that's the approach that became Diffie-Hellman system.
Right.
The other way of envisioning it is, well, suppose we split the cryptographic key, and this is the way I originally envisioned it. We split the cryptographic key in such a way that there's an encrypting capability and a decrypting capability.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't figure one out from the other. And so if I want to send you a message, loosely speaking, I go to the phone book, I look up your what's now your public key, I encrypt the message with your public key, and I send it to you. And even though everyone can know your public key and everyone sees the message I sent, only you, the one person who has the private key, can decrypt it.
Right. And the basis of the relationship between the public and private key has to be some sort of hard problem that we presume is NP complete.
Well, I think NP complete is sort of a sideshow in this matter.
Do you?
You know, there's an old joke about the man who's looking for his keys, and the policeman finds him searching under the traffic light.
Right.
And he says, what are you doing? I lost my keys. He says, where are you losing me? He points way over there in the dark. He says, why are you looking here? He says, well, the light's better. And we do a lot of that in research, and NP complete is one is one of the few insights into complexity theory that we had. So there's been a lot of talk about NP complexity.
Right.
But it's not, it only very crudely addresses this problem.
Yeah, I guess.
It does address it to some degree because it's NP, the NP region, you know, think about problems that go from easy to hard. What I'll call easy problems, adding, multiplying, and things like that, there's a certain theory of those things.
Right.
And then problems far too hard to make a cryptographic system out of, there's a theory of those things. But cryptography falls exactly at the area of NP complexity.
Yep.
Because in order for cryptography to be practical, now you don't get to talk on the show, I get to talk. In order for cryptography to be practical, you have to be able to encrypt and decrypt messages. So that has to go very quickly. But what that means is, if somebody breaks the code, that person can verify that the code has been successfully broken just by decrypting the message, which has to be easy. And so that draws, that pulls this problem into the area that is so difficult and is not well understood.
Yeah, it is interesting, but I guess, I mean, if somehow we were magically able to prove polynomial time and non-deterministic polynomial time were the same, what would happen to all the strong cryptography?
Well, it would depend entirely on what the polynomial was, and nobody knows.
Right. Interesting.
Right. I mean, it's realistic maybe to say that non-polynomial time computations are hard. The notion that polynomial time computations are easy is sort of a conceit of complexity theory. Suppose it were x to the 1,000, or maybe even x to the fifth. I mean, right? I mean, some of those things can grow pretty quickly. And remember, we're talking entirely, all these theories, the reason they have such limited application is all these theories, or that family of theories, are asymptotic.
Mm-hmm.
They have to do with what happens for arbitrarily large numbers, whereas any real crypto system is about something of fixed size. So in the case of AES, you know, it's about things that you do to 128-bit blocks. In the case of RSA or Diffie-Hellman, it's about things you do to 2,000-bit blocks. But in either case, what happens is you drift off toward a billion bits, a billion billion bits, Ackerman of a billion bits, etc., is really of no concern to you because you're never going to do those things.
Right, right. What are your thoughts about, you know, quantum cryptography, particle entanglement, all that stuff?
Well, I think that quantum cryptography is a very unfortunate term. I think there is a, partly because it's confused with something, another, it immediately brings to mind another term, or the two terms bring each other together, and the other one is quantum computation, and I'm sure we'll get back to that. But what is more reasonably called quantum key distribution is not implausible. Just incidentally, when quantum cryptography was first conceived, now you're going to have to help me, the son of the very famous president of MIT.
I don't think I'm going to be much service.
Wiesner. It was Stephen Wiesner, son of Jerome Wiesner.
Okay.
And it was a truly brilliant conception. It was an analogous, you know, there are two other areas in which you have something like this. In music recording and playing, stereo turned out to be immensely important in producing realism in a new direction from linearity of the amplifiers. And in communications, spread spectrum and the difficulty of intercepting it and the difficulty of spoofing it and so forth turned out to be a whole new direction in security from, say, the cryptographic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, quantum cryptography as originally conceived, and the physicists tell me this won't work, and nobody seems to work on this direction at the moment, but Stephen Wiesner conceived it. It was a communication that you could not record unless you could understand it.
Hmm.
All that would happen if you didn't know the keys and tried to record it was you'd ruin it. Now, as I say, they tell me that exact thing won't work, but because sort of a matter of efficiency. But you can get it to work well enough to use it for key management. And in the ideal circumstance, I don't know if anyone can do this yet, you imagine manufacturing key that is, so to speak, in two containers that are entangled with each other. And then you ship one to Fort Benning and one to Moscow. And whoever opens this container first freezes the key. And when the other person reads it, it will have an exact correspondence to the one that was opened first.
Right.
And if anybody opens it in the middle, they just destroy it. Right. So you will know when you try to read it that somebody has been fiddling with it.
Yeah,
it's extremely anti-escrow.
There was a result just recently about entangled particles at a larger distance than ever before, but it wasn't quite as far as Moscow to Fort Meade. But that's...
No, let me think a second. I've forgotten. I thought, let me think. It was done with a spool of optical fiber in Geneva or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
Ten,
yep. Somewhere
tens
near
of kilometers. I'm not sure what the current upper distances are.
Yeah.
In principle, the distance... The problem at the moment is not, I think... For as a practical thing, the problem is not the total distance. It's that you can't. I don't know of anyone who knows how to do it in the form I've just described it to you, which is roughly that the central facility manufactures this, you know, pair of USB sticks that are entangled, and then you put them in tamper-resistant packages and ship them wherever they're going. And as I say, whoever breaks open the package first freezes the keying agreement.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that would drop fit so nicely into a lot of current key management technique.
Yeah.
The techniques that we do have involve sort of communicating, having to negotiate key in a fashion analogous to Diffie-Hellman with certain a different basis for trust and more physics, less number theory, and somewhat different properties having to do with what would happen with a person in the middle.
Very interesting stuff. I'm not a cryptographer myself. In fact, my early work...
Go back to school.
I was a student of Doug Hofstetter's back in the day.
Oh, really?
And,
okay.
And so I wrote one of his...
That sounds like more general, you know, vision of the world anyway.
It was good, fun stuff. So I was intrigued to learn that, you know, that you'd done some work with John McCarthy at the AI lab. You alluded to it before, but what were you working on back then? And
I was working on... What the Russians have a nice term for this. They call it the mathematical theory of programming. But here it was just called proof of correctness of programs. Mm. And it is, I'm very pleased to have been rescued from it by cryptography because it hasn't made anything like, it's made some progress, but not as much progress as cryptography has. And I do not believe my work on it was headed to making the difference. So I was very pleased to be out of that.
Yeah.
That was one of John McCarthy's interests. John McCarthy had many.
Oh, of
that
course.
In itself is not artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
I always envisioned it as, you know, a matter of wanting to build very complex computer programs and very reliable computer programs, and we wanted to take both areas qualitatively beyond what we had at the time.
Right. I mean, I think that we... in some sense gave up on parts of that, but we've made some progress in finding bugs locally with some automatic bug-finding capability, but almost none.
I see that as a different thing.
Yeah,
I think that's a very good thing to do and underexplored.
Yep.
There's a woman named Cristina Cifuentes who was at Sun, I guess is now at Oracle Labs in Brisbane, I thought did some very, very fine work in that area.
Totally
and I
agree.
Have
yep.
followed what they've been doing with it.
Yeah, there are commercial tools that can do some very basic stuff now, but we certainly need more progress there. But we've made almost no progress being able to find design flaws at all. You know, so you can find a local problem isolated to a certain area that's mostly syntactic in nature, but we haven't figured out how to automate what a designer does.
Okay, that may be. It's interesting. My analysis of some work that they did, sort of ARPA-ish work in the 80s on this, was that they had a four-step process that went from the formal spec, in the semi-formal spec in English, you know, what the Army had asked for, to a high-level formal spec, to a low-level formal spec, to code.
Mm-hmm.
And the best results were improving correspondence between the high-level formal spec and the low-level formal spec. It was no clear way of formalizing the top layer of this process, and the bottom layer is the one that has done so poorly.
Mm-hmm.
I would have said where this has gone is toward the concept of proof-carrying code.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in proving the correctness of programs in general. My fantasy was an automated space station, you know, something the kind you might see in Battlestar Galactica, something those things weren't around yet.
Uh-huh.
Deep Space Nine, something of that kind. You know, things are constantly coming and going, and they're doing it very fast, and if one hits you, there's going to be the devil to pay.
Right.
And so the programs that run the space station really have to be correct. But proof-carrying code has a different view, which is that you don't try to prove everything. You merely try to prove that the code has certain properties. One obvious one sort of is, you know, proper stack management.
Right, yep.
And so, that's a direction. I like that, I guess, in part because my relationship with McCarthy was I worked some on what interested him and some on what interested me. And my viewpoint would now be called programming methodology rather than proof of correctness.
Got it.
As my view was, and probably is, that the reason we can't write correct programs, can't prove programs correct, is because we don't know how to write programs.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yep.
Yeah. It's good to agree with your interviewer. You end up, you know, using fewer dirty words.
We can beep them out later.
So you can hire an actor to dub them in if I don't, you know, say offensive enough things. Otherwise, nobody will listen to the stuff. Wait a minute. Just one of the things I was most pleased with that I did while I was at the iLab on stuff that interested John was organizing. I was working on the Lisp compiler.
Right.
Organizing it in such a way that if you didn't tamper with certain pieces of it, you're very unlikely, you know, I mean, yes, there's no formal proofs here, but if you did not tamper with a certain layer, you wouldn't get stack errors. If you didn't tamper with a layer below that, you wouldn't get syntactic errors in the assembly code.
Yep.
You know, some of the lower areas, I could do that.
Yep, that's quite important stuff.
Back to security.
I was a scheme guy, so I understand that. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. You know, what's interesting about proof-carrying code, just to get back to that a bit, in at least Nekula and Lee's version of it, there's also an asymmetric aspect to the idea, because it may be somewhat difficult to do the original proof about a certain property of a program, but it's pretty darn easy to make sure that proof is correct if you've already got the proof. And so
that's a fact of mathematics.
Yeah, that's a really cool fact.
That is to say, it's what makes mathematics possible. If the referees couldn't judge the correctness of the proofs, then you would never know what papers to publish. So in any interesting field of mathematics, not a triviality, in any interesting field of mathematics, the set or class of theorems is undecidable. If it's decidable, you know, I mean, there are things like propositional calculus that are decidable. You have a decision procedure that tells you whether any individual statement is a theorem. But
until Gödel comes along,
no, absolutely not. In propositional calculus is a decidable theory. You hand a proposition to the verifier, and it tells you whether it's true or not. That is not true of quantificational logic, which is incomplete. Right. But the critical point is, if you have a decidable piece of mathematics, like propositional calculus, that's not necessarily exactly trivial, right? But the point is, you don't do research in finding new propositions that are true, because the decider will tell you that.
Right, right.
In any real piece of mathematics, of course, now you don't have a systematic way of finding out whether any given theorem is true. But once you have given a proof, then there's a, in principle, I mean, this is not adequately automated, but the point is, it's decidable whether the proof is correct, and that's why the referees can go through and referee the paper. There's very few deeper facts about mathematics than that duality.
Yeah, that's very nice. So I want to switch gears a little. As the child of historians yourself, I think you were destined to be a careful thinker. Do you regret not going into academia further, or do you feel like you're in academia? What do you think about you think about those things?
I mean, I regret not having been the greatest thing since sliced bread, but I did what was within my capabilities and limitations.
Uh-huh.
And yes, in certain ways, I regret not having had a more academic career. But would I have done all of the things that I am proud of if I had? Who knows?
Yeah, right.
What I wanted then was to be Deligne, who was a man within a month or so of my age. He's a Belgian. He was a student of Grothendieck, who died a month or so ago. And he's one of the, you know, most celebrated names in late 20th century mathematics. And I would, in one sense, I I didn't actually, wasn't actually interested in that set of problems, but I imagined myself solving great classic problems in mathematics. Somewhat the way, and there are some mathematicians' careers like this. I mean, Gleason is probably the most, you know, big thing of his career is to solve Hilbert's fifth problem, which I am told, I've never studied the proof, loosely speaking, he sat and did problem sets for 20 years or something like that, and then he had the answer.
Yeah.
I felt ill-advised as a youth. And I didn't know, the historians talk about historiography, teaching people how history is done, where the sources of history are, what the methods are, etc. And nobody ever taught me very much about the research, realistic about the research world.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I had read Eric Temple Bell's Men of Mathematics. So in essence, I was trying to model my career on the mathematicians of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that has two faults. One, of course, I had a very classic vision of mathematics, right? There's lots, yes, I learned more, saw a wider world in that direction when I was in MIT, but my mattering map, so to speak, what things seem, you know, I really wanted to see things like the Riemann hypothesis solved, which, you know, no question, that kind of thing is important. But in fact, the easier, and in some sense, I don't have quite the right adjective, but the more useful to the world thing for a young researcher to do is to see the things that are ill-defined in concept. Right? So you rather, as opposed to looking in, you know, yes, some people are very, very smart and they solve an old problem because nobody before them saw how to do it or was as smart or was as hardworking or whatever. But other people, and I think the people we remember best, saw problems with the way things were thought about at the moment, and saw how to resolve them.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not as loose as some of them, but look, special relativity, in my view, is a worship-worthy discovery. Who in the world would have thought that the problem of resolving Galilean relativity against the constancy of the speed of light was going to be to make time change? That's just really, you know, that man deserves the
respect
that he gets.
Exactly. That's sort of a deep insight.
And, you know, I mean, so if you look, and isn't another thing, I mean, I read Rebecca Goldstein's biography of Gödel a few years ago, and I wished I had read that. Of course, it wasn't written until a few years ago, but there's a statement in there that every young aspiring intellect should read, which is that Gödel determined not to waste his time on any problem that could be solved by lesser minds. Now that's really very good career guidance. I mean, it doesn't tell you how to judge how good you are and things of that kind. But the point is, he aimed, you know, he looked at things. He thought, I'd say, what are the most important problems, and then he set out to solve them.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So I want to ask you a quasi political question that has to do with cryptography. I know that.
Okay, I'll give you a. Yeah.
I know that you're around
famous for his quasi politics
in the crypto wars in the early days, and recently the FBI director James Comey seems to imply that he'd like to put some back doors into modern systems for law enforcement reasons, which a lot of us think is just a terrible idea. Why is that a terrible idea?
Well, in the explicit case that James Comey is thinking about, it seems to me that you have to look at the difference between a free society and a tyranny. And in any, the essence, you know, the bottom line of society is that you're answerable for your actions. You're responsible. You bear the consequences of your actions.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that manifests in this case is that if I know something that the court can legitimately order me to tell them, and you know this is a complex. I'm not trying to address all of the past and future case law on that point, but the basic mechanism, the court comes and says to me, you know, tell us this, or you're going to sit in jail for a while. Justice James issue James Risen is facing today.
Mm-hmm.
Is James Risen, you know, he's willing to go to jail rather than to reveal his source because he thinks it is so important, the right and the power of reporters to talk to sources and protect them is indispensable to the news business and to democracy.
Right.
On the other hand, and I started out talking about the difference between a free society and a tyranny, what Kony wants is that you never get to make that choice. They can always go, in any information you have, they can always take it from you without your permission.
Right.
So that you have no freedom to refuse anything to the state. And that's in some sense, that's a relatively new notion. That is to say, nobody spying on communications and spying on people's work in progress and stuff like that was primitive at the time of the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the king wanted to know what Adams was saying to Washington, there really was, you know, all they had to do was walk off 100 yards from other people and talk. And unless the king had one of them on his payroll, he wasn't going to learn what they said. So privacy of communication. Communication had certain limits, but there was a solid privacy of face-to-face communication, which was the most important mode of communication in society at that time.
Right.
Now we move into a society where, unquestionably, that one's still important. But for the first time within the 20th century or so, the remote communication has become feasible. Remote real-time communication has become feasible and has risen to challenge face-to-face communication as a component of culture.
Right.
So, you know, you and I may never meet. Nonetheless, we can talk very satisfactorily on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And some people in society go through, you know, lifetimes not meeting and either working together or conducting friendships, having phone sex, and all of that sort of thing. And we can expect that as communications improve, as we go from, you know, kilobaud to terabaud, the reality of these remote encounters will be greater and greater.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you have that if you adopt the principle that any such thing, because it's a remote communication, has to be made accessible to the state, then you really no longer, I don't see how you can have a free society under those circumstances.
Yep.
Or at least not one that doesn't have an awful bug in the sense that it can move away from freedom in a way that can't be corrected.
Yeah, very,
and,
very nicely stated.
Well, I mean, there's something like that was said by the famous senator from the Watergate era, who was head of the Senate Select Committee to investigate. You know, the one who's just a poor old country lawyer.
I was only 6 at the time.
Well, you should have been a more precocious 6.
Gosh,
Obama was only... Actually, oh, you're only 6. You're younger than Obama. Obama, I remember, was 7 when the weatherman undertook his activities. Church, Frank Church. And Church,
yes.
There's the statement you can look up in churches that says, roughly speaking, that if NSA, if the intelligence community is allowed to turn its power on the American people, there will be no freedom and no way of restoring democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that looks very prophetic at the moment.
Yeah, me too. How about if we go slightly triter? You were working at Sun when Scott McNeely said privacy was dead, were you not?
Yeah, well, that presents a problem for me. One, I mean, it didn't make my job any easier.
Yeah, I wondered
but on
what
the
your
other
reaction
hand,
was.
No, I mean, no, yeah, right. With a boss like this, I don't need enemies. but the problem is there's a great deal of truth. I don't remember exactly. I don't know what the exact quote is. Something more like, you have no privacy on the Internet, get over it.
Get over it,
and
yeah,
there
that's
certainly
right.
was a lot of truth to that. And it's a very difficult problem to solve because in one sense it's clearly gotten worse since then. On the other hand, a great deal about the way the world works that we like, I think turns on that stuff. And so, you know, imagine, here's another, you know, one of my fantasies, of imagine, you know, you have a spaceship, and put aside politics, so to speak, in the question of trust. You imagine a system, it's a very large spaceship, it's not tiny like the Enterprise, it's, you know, 1,000 kilometers across or some decent size for a starship. You want to talk to somebody, you just speak that person's name, and the sound systems, you know, subject to whatever the sort of alerting mechanisms are and so forth, but basically, I just stand here in this room, and I speak your name, and you hear it wherever you are, because it, and you know, and so there's no pipe. The spaceship tracks where everybody is,
right?
And knows whom, and who, you know. When I say Herman, I want to speak to one particular one, almost certainly, and so that kind of mechanism is much. If you have trust, if you put aside the issue of trust, then you get all sorts of wonderful things out of this.
Mm-hmm.
To have, you know, have systems tracking you around so they know where to find you when you want to be found. They know how to tell you, you know, what restaurants are local. All these things that Google and everybody are either doing or developing are immensely useful. The problem is, one, incidentally, I don't think we have quite the right words for things. Because privacy, the word privacy doesn't express the difference between the things you want and the things you don't.
Mm.
So people say things like, you know, there's no privacy in small towns. And in a large sense, that's true. On the other hand, what there is in small towns is a lot of accountability.
Yep.
Because the people who know about you are people you know about. And one, they're more likely maybe to understand you, but also they're not capriciously going to offend you because they're just as vulnerable to you as you are to them.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, ChoicePoint or Equifax and such couldn't care less about us. We have no visibility into their operations, and they have lots of visibility into ours. So it's that asymmetry of transparency in which the individual is transparent to the large organizations, and the large organizations are not accountable to the individuals.
Yeah, it's a thorny thing. Very, very interesting. I have one last off-the-wall question for you.
What, have you been through 9 of them? I only heard about 3.
I don't know. What is your favorite piece?
I thought you said you had 9 questions. I thought you told me you had 9 questions.
Oh, I don't. I just have a little list.
You just have some questions.
Some.
Okay.
What's your
Lord,
favorite?
You have some apples in that basket.
It's a hole full of apples. What is your favorite piece of visual art?
Oh, gosh. The first thing popped into mind was a Renoir picture called Jeune Fille Assise, painted in 1909 of a woman in a white blouse. And for some reason that came to mind the other day, and I looked up the model, whose name is something like Hélène Belin, and she died in 1959, just about the time I discovered the painting.
Very, very nice. Well, thanks for your time today. It's been incredibly
nice. Well, you're very welcome.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The September-October 2014 issue of IEEE S&P focuses on CSERTs and incident response. The issue also features our conversation with Bart Billner about open source, Heartbleed, fuzz, and analysis tools. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.